Okay, I think we'll make a start. Warm welcome to everybody and to this seminar with Professor William Sullivan. My name is Hege Hermansson, and I work with the Preparing for Professional Practice program, or what we call Program for Fremragende Profesjonskvalifisering, FPK, together with my colleague Sylvie, who's up in the corner there, and Anton. And we're very pleased to introduce this lecture with Sullivan today. What we're particularly interested in today is his conceptual model of the three apprenticeships, which we think is a very useful way of thinking about and analyzing integration in professional education. And this goes back to how a key challenge for all of us in our educational programs is this thing about how to integrate theory and practice. And he's also introducing the third dimension, which is the apprenticeship of norms and values. So he'll be introducing this today, and as some of you know, this is in a sense a series of two workshops. So we have a workshop this coming Thursday, that's now on the 15th. It starts at 12:30 till 3:30, and we still have some spaces left in this workshop if anyone would like to join. This today is primarily a lecture, whereas on Thursday the workshop participants will be working actively to analyze and think about their own educational programs. So this will be, on Thursday we'll have much more of a workshop format with group work and discussions and so on. So if anyone would like to join our workshop on Thursday, please just see me after the lecture and I'll sign you up. Okay. So, would you like to start?
Thank you. Thank you, Hege. Good afternoon. And let me say I'm very grateful that you've been willing to come out for this. And I'm going to do my best anyway to make it less formal than it might otherwise be, although the format of the room, of course, suggests a certain one-way flow in the information. But I think we'll have some time as well for discussion. I hope we will. And let me say, too, that I'm delighted to be back in Oslo, and it's especially nice to be here when spring apparently is about to happen. So I'm very conscious of all the little signs of emerging spring. And I know that Saturday is a very important day. And you should know that I've been actually confined against my will. So I will not be able to leave Oslo until after the 17th of May. So I get to actually experience National Day. So what I want to do this afternoon is, as Hege's already suggested, set some context that will be useful for this workshop on Thursday, and also, knowing that many of you won't be able to attend the workshop, to provide what I hope will be some introduction to this concept of the three apprenticeships of professional education. And the way I thought to do that would be to begin with a problem. And really, it's the problem that this idea of the three apprenticeships is designed to address, not necessarily to solve, but to provide a framework or a perspective within which to approach the problem. So what is the problem? The problem, I think, could be put, if I could make a reference here to mathematics, the problem is really one of squaring a circle. Now, here I'm going to walk out onto very thin ice, given my limited mathematical knowledge. But the analogy, I think, would be like this, that as I remember, anyway, from years ago studying plane geometry, that the problem in geometry, at least as Euclid conceived it, is that there are, in fact, we can conceive these figures called circles, but geometry is built up from concepts of line and point. So the problem for Euclid really was how, in fact, to describe the area of a circle, which is a continuous line, of course, of a certain kind that has a fixed diameter, a diameter from a fixed center, how to describe that in reference to or in terms of points and lines. The analogy is that professional practice is our circle. For the expert practitioner or even the competent practitioner carrying out a profession is really a kind of seamless circular process in which the practitioner identifies problems, is able to apply expert technique and knowledge to the problems so that the problems are resolved. And from that experience, the practitioner also gains new knowledge or information, which can be then, as we say, fed back into that performance for the future. However, for a long time, we've been training professionals in institutions such as this, institutions of higher education. And higher education is not primarily focused on practice of that kind. It, of course, is full of practices. And in fact, I'm engaging probably not so well in one of those characteristic practices of lecturing or talking about a subject. But if you think of the difference between my talking about what it is to practice, let us say, engineering, or to practice teaching, or nursing, or law, or medicine, or architecture, and the actual wherewithal that you have to be able to practice those things, I think you can see the immediate gap. So if you were students in any of those fields, and I described to you how to do certain of the characteristic activities of the field, and you took dutiful notes, and you reviewed your notes, and in fact, you could probably then pass a test or a quiz which would show that you understood or could describe all of those actions, almost surely that would not be enough to enable you to actually carry out the action or practice. So there is a real gap between theory in that sense, a kind of verbal, or in some cases mathematical, understanding of what practice is about, on the one hand, and the actual practice of any of those professional fields that I've just talked about, on the other. So what I'd like to do is to, in effect, provide a few small examples with a question around them. Let me start with the question. The question is going to be, what's missing if you think of these examples as preparations for practicing particular professions? What's missing, or what is unbalanced, let us say, in these examples? So, example one, which I'll draw from the field of engineering. Engineering, after World War II, was in many ways, particularly in the United States, which is the field, the area in which I know best, was in many ways reinvented as something that came to be called engineering science. So before World War II in the U.S., engineering schools, and therefore students of engineering going to those schools, spent a good deal of time doing what we would now call hands-on engineering practice. They actually learned how to build things, for example, or they would take apart motors and reconstruct them, and so on. And to some degree, at least, those courses were taught by practicing engineers. After World War II, it was thought that this was really not intellectually respectable. In other words, engineering education needed to be upgraded. It had to be upgraded to be more representative of scientific knowledge. So, in effect, the engineering curricula, which were developed from the 1950s and 60s forward, were applied science, or at least that's how they thought of them, which meant, and still means, that students spend most of their engineering curriculum taking courses in rooms like this, which look very much like courses in physics, except that they often have somewhat different names. So students would learn all the basic principles of dynamics, for example, as well as principles of static analysis, the things that would be fundamental to understanding, for example, how buildings stay up, or how motors work, or how electrical components actually function. But only toward the end of the curriculum would students begin to have some direct exposure to what these concepts were referring to. In other words, only toward the end of the curriculum did students actually spend a lot of time in laboratories and, very importantly, but marginally, in what came to be called studios of design. So that's example one. And remember, I'm asking this the general question, if that is the full amount of preparation for this profession, what's missing or what's not quite right about that? Everyone sees the idea? So let's think about another very different field, namely the preparation of teachers for primary and secondary education. In schools of education, in much of the world, not all of it, but certainly very heavily in the United States, the development of curricula moved in a way somewhat similar to what was going on in engineering. So if we looked at the preparation of teachers 100 years ago in the U.S., it took place largely in what were then called normal schools, based on the French model, in which teachers were prepared to teach particular subject matters, often actually the very they were being prepared for the very specific curricula that were taught in schools in the area in which they were attending normal school. In the U.S., that would be based on states such as Nebraska or New York or California or Alabama, so on. Over time, teacher preparation was moved from normal schools into colleges and universities. And when that happened, the curricula became more general. So instead of attempting to prepare students to teach particular subjects in the local schools, the new university-housed schools of education saw themselves as presenting curricula that would teach teachers to teach that subject anywhere, to use, so to speak, any textbook to teach any group of students. And the educators in the schools of education thought that in order to do that, they really had to, much the way the engineers were thinking at that point, they had to upgrade this whole process intellectually. It had to become more theoretical. So schools of education in the U.S. have for a long time presented several years of curriculum which teach the theory of teaching before students have any experience of entering a classroom. And when they do enter a classroom, typically they are then under the supervision of what are called cooperating teachers, who have only a loose connection to the faculty of the school of education. After they complete a year of practice teaching, following several years of their curriculum in the university, they, if they pass their courses, they're then given a certificate to be able to teach. So the question I'm asking is, what's missing in that process? Since particularly in the U.S., there is considerable complaint that new teachers are not really up to the job. There are a lot of other problems in U.S. higher education, in education, but one of the key ones is this transition of new teachers from their university preparation into the actual experience of teaching. And then to provide a third and somewhat different one of the major professions in the U.S., certainly a very high status, an important profession here too, but there are far more graduates of such institutions in the U.S. proportional to the population than in Norway, namely lawyers, in the U.S. are typically trained after an undergraduate degree. So law in the U.S. is a graduate degree, and it is a three-year course of study at a law school, many of which are university connected. Law schools in the U.S. teach in a very distinctive way. They teach in what's called the Socratic method, which is an interesting way of analyzing cases. And if you were to talk to legal educators in the U.S., what you would discover is that uniformly they believe that their main function is to teach legal reasoning, to teach students, as they say, how to think like a lawyer. And they do that by training students to analyze the way in which judges have ruled on cases, in particular in the U.S. on how the Supreme Court has ruled on cases that have been brought to the Supreme Court on appeal. That process goes on for 3 years. Following that, students typically sit for what's called the bar examination, which is independently administered, but which also tests students' ability to reason legally about cases. If students, and when students, pass the bar examination, they then are entitled to, as they say in the U.S., hang out a shingle, put up a sign announcing that they are practicing lawyers. And so what they will then be doing is soliciting clients who are willing to entrust them with their cause, their case, at law. Would you willingly go to someone who had just graduated from such a program with an important legal problem? And that is another way of asking, what's wrong or what's missing in that kind of education? So let me pause for just a moment and ask, what do you think is missing in any of those three models? Would anyone care to venture an opinion? Engineering science.
Anton. Could it be something about understanding the engineering as a social sort of structure, as part of society, the role of engineering or engineers?
Well, certainly that was not part of engineering science. The question was whether the social function of engineering, the role of the engineer, was not part of the discussion. And that's certainly true, that it was not part of engineering science. So, yes.
My way of understanding your questions and what is similar in these three contexts is that they are not building on the experience, real, authentic experience of the students early in the program, in a way. So they just learn about it in a more deductive way, theoretically, listening to others' experience instead of making own experience and build upon it.
Yes, that in none of those cases was there any attention given to students' actual experience of the practice.
Yeah, or
early in the program, yes.
That is what I'm thinking about.
Yes, correct. And so I think the significance of that problem emerges most clearly in the case of the lawyers. And that's why I asked, would you entrust a new lawyer with your legal problem? And the reason I suspect many of us would hesitate to do that would be because we would recognize immediately that given that kind of preparation, the lawyer, as we would say, I think, had no experience of handling a case. And in fact, that really is true in the U.S. So a continuing problem or an issue in the legal world in the U.S. is complaints by judges in particular that young lawyers just coming out of law school who've just passed the bar examination frequently don't seem to be competent to represent clients, even though they have passed their exams and therefore they are officially certified as entitled to represent clients. So there's something about competence which seems to be missing in that kind of legal education. The result is now serious efforts to reform legal education, which have as their chief component just what you've described of trying to find ways to bring students into direct contact with practice so as to begin to build up some experience or practice while also learning to, as they say, reason like a lawyer. Because another way of saying it is that functioning as a lawyer requires legal reasoning as a kind of necessary condition, a sort of necessary skill, but it requires a lot of other skills beyond legal reasoning itself, skills that have to do with learning how to relate to clients. In particular, that one of the chief problems for lawyers like physicians and nurses is being able to draw out from clients what their actual problems are. And often that requires a kind of translation because the clients typically are not going to go to the lawyer with a legal formulation of their problem. If they could do that, they probably wouldn't need the lawyer in the first place. They're going to go with a kind of common sense perception of what the problem is. And the lawyer, then, the skill of the lawyer, is to find what the legal question is. That's part of that situation. Much as the skill of the physician is to extract the medical facts from a more complex human situation, which is also what nurses encounter. And in fact, I think we could generalize that and say that's what professionals typically do, is they meet lay people, ordinary people, often in situations of need or problematic situations in which the way in which the client or patient expresses the situation is going to be quite different from the way in which the theory of that field analyzes it. So that the professional's role is very much one of translation, and the first part of that translation requires being able to understand what the person, the client, the patient is really talking about, what their experience actually is. There's certainly a parallel in learning to teach. I think another parallel in the case of engineering. But I don't think I need to go on at great length on that. The purpose of raising these questions, though, really, was then to suggest, back to this analogy of squaring a circle, that the way in which professional education has evolved or developed, at least in the last century or so, has been to emphasize the academic, theoretical features of professional life, of the professional field. Often to the exclusion, or at least by minimizing attention to what one of you has just called authentic experience. That is, students' encounters with the practice of the profession itself. So over the last decade, or now a little going back a couple of years, between 2000 and 2010, I was at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching in California, where we conducted a series of studies of professional education, where we found this to be a recurrent theme. And in order to make sense of that, and we found this, I should say, in studies of law, studies of nursing, studies of engineering, studies of medicine, studies of the ministry. In order to make sense of that, what we eventually developed was what I want to refer to today as a notion of professional education as a kind of apprenticeship. Now, I'm using apprenticeship here really in a metaphorical, not a literal sense, although there are areas in professional education in which there is literal apprenticeship, that is to say, in which an aspiring member of a profession actually works closely under the supervision of one master practitioner. But very often in professional school, a student is not apprenticed to one practitioner. If they're apprenticed, we could say they're apprenticed to the whole school. They're apprenticed to a whole structure. So in that sense, it's metaphorical rather than literal. So what we discovered in the process of doing these studies was that students, when they went to professional school, when they apprenticed as nurses or physicians or engineers, were in fact meeting three very separate kinds of apprenticeship. So instead of a circle, instead of a closely integrated performance, which is what the expert practitioner does, students in fact were first encountering the profession as three rather separate kinds of experience. So what I've just been describing in those three cases are instances in which the first apprenticeship, that is to say, the academic or cognitive aspects of the field, what we might refer to simply as the theory of the field, were given special prominence. So when engineering education in the U.S. pushed out a lot of laboratory and field-based experience in industry, for example, and replaced that in the curriculum with more courses in applied physics, they were in effect attempting to upgrade or enhance the cognitive theoretical features of the preparation. What was missing in this, or what was being downgraded at that point, was really what we've called the second apprenticeship. That is to say, the actual learning of skilled practice. Now, what we discovered in these studies of the several fields was that all of the professional fields, or professional schools, at some point provide some of this. And that really is what separates professional preparation from other kinds of academic work. Because all of the professions require that their graduates have to be able to do, at least to a very basic level, to do what professionals in that field actually do. And there's simply no way to learn to do those things except, to paraphrase John Dewey, but even before that, paraphrase Aristotle, there's no way to learn to do things except by doing them. But because of the predominance of the first apprenticeship, we discovered that for the most part, the second apprenticeship was very much a second consideration. Now, why would I say that? Because if we look at the organization of the professional school for just a moment, one of the striking things about virtually all professional schools is that the first and second apprenticeships are taught by different instructors. So there is, so to speak, usually a theoretical faculty, and that faculty often has the highest status. And then there is a kind of practice faculty, which often has a lower status. Why? If, in fact, these are fields in which it's essential that, in fact, not only essential, but in which aim at high levels of skilled practice, why would those instructors who actually teach that usually have a status lower than the instructors who teach the theory. Why? Does that make any sense? We were genuinely puzzled by this, because it was striking that we found this, for example, in schools of engineering, but we discovered it was also true in schools of education. It tended to be the case in schools of nursing. In fact, in schools of nursing, very often the second apprenticeship is typically handled by nurses who are not themselves on the faculty of the school, also often in schools of education. And in law school, very definitely, those who teach in what is called clinical legal education are often adjunct to the school itself. But would anyone want to hazard a hypothesis as to why this difference in status?
I think it's a general problem, maybe a problem, because I work with vocational education, and it's certain that vocational education has lower status than theoretical education. I think it's the same in universities. It's more status to being a researcher or a teacher, and practice is everywhere. I think, has lower status than
knowledge. That's the conclusion that we were forced to, essentially, that the academy as an institution, that institution which we all live and work and love, is an institution that essentially focuses on theoretical work. And as you say, there's even a kind of hierarchy between research and scholarship on the one hand and teaching, because teaching already starts to smack a bit of practice. Now, this may or may not be great or a good thing for the development of science, scholarship, and theory. But certainly I think it's reasonable to question whether that's a good thing for the education of professionals. And that really was the premise of our studies, that we thought it was very important to somehow enable particularly educators in these fields to make sense of this situation, which otherwise, I think, or maybe not even otherwise, we can just say, because it does have a kind of squaring the circle quality to it. That the very criteria which are emphasized in the academy, which push in the direction of theoretical brilliance, and therefore remove from practice, those very criteria seem to militate against what the professional programs are most interested in, which is to say the education or training of skilled practitioners. Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yes. I have to stay in this zone or I can't be seen. So.
Did you find this pattern in all educations? Because I'm sitting and thinking about doctors and artists, mm-hmm. and wondering, is it the same case in those areas, or are there areas that have different patterns?
Yes, that's a great question. Let me return to that in just a moment, because you pulled two very interesting examples. I know a lot more about doctors than I know about artists. But I think just one quick footnote on that what you can immediately notice, though, is that the arts have always had a kind of secondary status in the university. They're a problem for the university because I think of this. Is it the performing artist or the great painter or whatever who is important in the university, or is it the literary critic, the arts critic, the theorist of that, who's often real confusion or ambiguity on that question. But let me return to the physician question in a moment. Yes.
Yeah, but I also wanted to ask about the pattern, and because it surprised me that you found that pattern in the law studies, because I would have thought rather opposite.
Mm.
And I also wonder if you found, would gender mean anything?
Interesting. Yeah. Very. These are just the kinds of questions that we found ourselves asking and trying to get some kind of answer on. But let me ask you sort of a question in return. Why would you think that law would be different?
Because in Norway, for instance, those who practice law mm-hmm. are earning, well, let me say, five times more than professors, for instance. So that gives yeah. them a kind of a high status.
Uh-huh. So yes. Why. Interesting. Okay. That's also true in the U.S., although the faculty of law is, so to speak, like medicine, is much better paid than most of the other disciplines in the university, which gives rise to a certain amount of resentment toward them. But what makes that different, I think, at least in the American context, is the tremendous prestige of the judiciary. So the courts have high prestige, although they don't pay in the same way in which a Wall Street law firm would pay its partners.
In Norway, we have problems in getting people to apply for a job as a judge.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh. Okay. I didn't know that, so that's useful for me to know. Let me return now just quickly, though, to this question about physicians for a moment, and because then we can, I think, start to see something important here. That what we discovered is that this hierarchy is there in medical education, in that in schools of medicine, the high prestige positions are frequently, back to your point too, research positions. But medicine, however, is also a field in which there are very few pure theoreticians. That they have to maintain some relationship to the practice. Less true in law school, interestingly. But because of that, perhaps, it's also the case that while medical school begins with several years of theoretical preparation, most of medical training is in fact clinical. Nursing, which is quite different in its structure from medical education, is another field in which at least half of the training is clinical and must be. In fields like those, and I think this could be generalized to the health professions as a group, in those fields, the second apprenticeship is very important, just because so much of the actual preparation goes on there. And that makes them different from fields like engineering or education, in which there is less time spent in the second apprenticeship. Now, that doesn't, however, equal the idea that those who teach in the second apprenticeship in these cases are given higher status than those who teach in the first. Typically, they're not. And as I said, very interestingly, in nursing, most of the second apprenticeship training actually is not carried out by nursing faculty. It's carried out by practicing nurses in practice settings. And that's also true typically, and certainly in the U.S., in education. So it's a complicated situation. But one very important feature of this is what I want to now emphasize. That is that the stronger the second apprenticeship is in a particular field, we discovered another surprising relationship. the stronger the second apprenticeship we found, the more attention was given to what I haven't talked about at all until this moment, the third. So the third apprenticeship, we called the third because it often seems to be a sort of afterthought. Now, it's not an afterthought in the mind of the public. What the public really wants to know most of the time, they want to know that a professional that they're depending on is competent, and part of that competence in the public mind is that that professional is going to put the patient's or the client's interest first. In other words, that the orientation of the professional is one of service and a general sense of public service, what we refer to sometimes as a kind of civic orientation to the profession. The public thinks that's really important and is very distressed, actually, when it turns out that various practitioners in different fields are not interested in the public good, or maybe are simply becoming rich themselves. In the U.S., there was a recent, very large scandal, actually, in which it turned out that Medicare, which is our only state-supported universal health care, which is a health care for older senior citizens, that a huge portion of the Medicare budget was actually going to a very small number of physicians who were making millions and millions of dollars by ordering all kinds of extravagant tests, really terrible practice of medicine. But the public was outraged at that because that was a clear violation of what the public believes professions are about. What's important, though, is that to the degree to which practice becomes important, it seems that questions of like what the profession is for, and on your point earlier about engineering's role, let's say, in society, that those questions become more prominent. So they enter the education, even when they're not officially described as part of the education. Whereas to the degree to which the field remains heavily focused on the first apprenticeship, there seems to be less attention given to this question of the norms, values, identity of the professional. So although there isn't an identity, there is a linkage, I think, between learning the practice and the formation of the ethical identity, we could call it that, of the professional. And that may be partly why that issue comes out differently in at least the studies that we did at the Carnegie Foundation in these different fields. So if we were to ask, as we did ask, where do we find very strong formation of professional identity, and where do we find it to be quite weak? We discovered that the strongest formation of professional identity seemed to be in nursing. This is something that nursing does very well. It's also strong in medicine. It's relatively weaker, we discovered, in fields like engineering and law, although because we didn't study it in the same way, I can't speak as clearly about the preparation of teachers, but there is evidence that it is also weak there. So there seems to be a kind of general correlation, at least, between the first apprenticeship separating out theory from questions of values and identity, whereas the second apprenticeship seems to require, to force questions of values and identity in the process of learning how to practice the field. So let me just pause for a moment, because the questions have been so good. I don't want to cut off any further thoughts and ask, does anyone want to raise any other questions or make any observations, really just about this scheme? because then I want to move to what will really be a concluding point of what you might do with the scheme. But before that, I just wonder if anyone wants to ask or say anything else about it.
Do you find any differences between good practice and bad practice? Because, for example, teacher students report back after practice periods that, oh, my tutor was not the kind of teacher I want to be.
Yes. Yes. Very common in practice experiences, actually.
That what then about the identity and the ethics and...
What I think those experiences do, and we saw this, we heard this probably most strongly in medical education, actually. That same comment, though, of both medical students and then later postgraduate residents who are already physicians, but still in training, saying, boy, I've really learned from working with so-and-so what I don't want to be or what I don't want to do. Now, what then becomes crucial, I think, is how the faculty instructor, the instructor as mentor, responds to that observation. Because what's happening, in effect, is the student is simultaneously starting to reflect about the student's own identity or own sense of values and the field. So it may be the first time that a student has really thought seriously about what it is to be a teacher or a doctor or a nurse or whatever the field may be. So that's, I think, what we have to call very emphatically a teachable moment. That's one of the key moments in the actual development of a professional. Unfortunately, however, we found that the educators in these fields have not, on the whole, thought much about this systematically. And in fact, one of our purposes in these studies was to try to raise this sort of question. And this scheme is at least one device to try to prompt that, because the scheme really asks the instructors, collectively, the whole faculty really in the field, to think about what they're doing. And particularly what we tried to do in the studies is to keep making the point that if the field doesn't address this, if it doesn't address it explicitly, they should be aware that it is being taught implicitly by what students actually are learning. Or what students, you might say, what the kind of meaning or sense the students are giving to what they experience. So, very important question. Yes?
I'm thinking about if in your studies, those who are lifting up the second and the third level, because if you're pushing the first one, then I think they have more and more pages to read in the study. But do you see something about if we are going to lift up number second and third, and we have to reduce a little the pages that the students have to study? If you lift up the practical approach, do you find something inside in your study about pages to read?
Yes. Very, very good question, because what you're, another way of putting that, I think, is you've just given the way in which much of the teaching faculty in a given field responds to these sorts of conversations. They'll say, well, yes, that's important. Yes, that's important. But we have to cover all of this.
Yeah, so then you don't have any more time.
Yes,
almost.
Exactly. Exactly.
If you have seen something in your materials.
Yes. The answer is yes, because what that leads to, I think, again, this is analogous to how the teachable moment for students, the teachable moment for the instructors is then to raise the question of, well, what are they trying to do in assigning those pages? What's the purpose of that learning. And I think what inevitably, if one were Socratic about it, what it wouldn't be hard to lead virtually anyone to see that the purpose of that is not, so to speak, an end in itself. It's really to be able to produce a professional who is able to, as we say in these books, integrate all three of these. And that means thinking about pedagogy, thinking about how does theory relate to practice, and vice versa, how does practice influence theory? And that's really the goal of the studies, is to provoke among educators that conversation, not as a one moment's reflection, but really to try to initiate that as what professional faculties should be constantly talking about. And that's actually a good connection to where I want to end, which is the question of what could you do with this as a scheme? And I could just list a couple of possibilities and sort of suggest a line, but this would be something that I want to pursue this workshop on Thursday in more detail. One thing you can do with it is it enables you to make an inventory, so to speak, to find out what a given program of study is really doing. Where does its emphasis, where does it place its emphasis? And that, I think, then leads very naturally to the ability to map the curriculum in a different way than typical. So to think of this as a kind of way to draw a map. Where does the first apprenticeship get taught in a particular course of study? Who teaches it? Who are the instructors for that? What is the pedagogy that they use? Is it lectures? Right? Are there other kinds of ways of learning these things that have been shown to be perhaps more effective? How do they assess that learning? So those kinds of questions, I think, fit very well as applications of the scheme. And that's really what I mean by a kind of inventory of coming to understand a program of study in, I think, a more dramatic, but also more dynamic way than is typically done. So it's not so much a question of coverage, again. It's a question of what kinds of expertise are you developing? And how does that come together, or how should it come together to develop the expertise typical of that profession or field? Now, there are a number of ways in which these notions get developed in the Carnegie studies that I was referring to. But here I'd like to conclude really with just one notion that, and it's tied to this observation about coverage versus, and if I could put it this way, coverage versus learning. That some of the more interesting studies that our research teams didn't actually do in this case, but they were drawing upon studies, have been attempts to understand how experts in these fields actually think and act in practice. And of course, once you turn to that kind of study, it immediately exposes the fact that experts are using all three of these. And it's very hard to actually pull them apart. One of the reasons, by the way, that experts in different fields do not necessarily make good teachers is that in acquiring their expertise, they have in fact learned to meld and blend their experience, knowledge, what they've acquired from others, and to make it second nature, to make it, so to speak, just part of their habits. So it becomes very difficult for them to then think back, they probably can't very often think back as to where they learned that or how they learned it. It would be like asking one of us, well, how did you learn to walk in a straight line? Right? Can you help me do that? Probably not. So teaching or educating requires, in effect, a kind of not so much an unlearning as being able to see the stages by which someone actually moves from beginner to competent to expert, which is a way of saying that the profession of teaching is a genuine profession in its own right in that regard. But what this raises then, I think, from these studies is the interesting notion of understanding how practitioners use theory, or how theory influences practice. And someone said the other way around. And that really is what I think educational research in the professions today is about. It's certainly one of its most important purposes, is to really try to get clearer, to use words one of colleagues here has used several times in the last few days, to open the black box of what goes on when people acquire expertise and try to understand how that works, so as to be able then to improve the teaching of the expertise. A very popular metaphor for this today is to think about teaching as more like coaching. Well, it's more like coaching when, if you think about it in terms of the second apprenticeship. Not necessarily or always in the first, but certainly I think it's fair to say much of the learning of expertise is like coaching, in that you're attempting to give feedback to learners on how they're doing. But the learners actually have to try to do it. They have to try to imitate the practice in order for that learning process to get started. And that's why some experience of actually attempting to do it is so important in professional education. So I'll end there and suggest that I'm offering these categories really as a kind of general scheme, try to suggest a couple of ways by which it can be useful. First, in a critical way, as a kind of critique, to see what's often missing or unbalanced in existing programs of professional preparation. But then turning it the other way as a kind of positive device to make possible clearer and deeper thinking about how to make professional preparation work better. Understanding that as analogous to our circle, as the development of an integrated whole capacity or expertise defined by the ends of the particular field. Thank you.
Thank you for a very engaging and inspiring and thoughtful lecture. For those of you who'd like to continue the conversation with Sullivan and apply these perspectives to your own educational programs, feel free to join us on Thursday. And if you haven't signed up already, you can do so with me now. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Thank you again. Thank you.